I wanted to be part of the world, but I didn't see anyone like me in it.
I hear about a summer camp for the handicapped run by hippies. Somebody said you probably all smoke dope with the counselors, and I'm like, sign me up.
Even when we were that young, we helped empower each other. It was allowing us to recognize that the status quo is not what it needed to be.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Contiki Podcast, the place to drop by and get double feature film recommendations from some of your favorite artists, musicians, and filmmakers. You know, people that know me tend to know that I wear my Ohio roots on my sleeve a bit. It's something I'm very proud of. A lot of projects that I've done in the past revolve around Ohio, and in particular, Dayton, the town where I'm from. It's just always struck me as such a unique place in a small town in a lot of ways, but a town that has yielded so many creative minds. You know, we're talking about Bob Pollard and Guided by Voices. We're talking about Kim Deal and Kelly Deal and the Breeders. We're talking about Brainiac. We're talking about the invention of flight and the Wright Brothers. We're talking about the history of funk with Roger and Zapp and the Ohio Players and Lakeside. It goes on and on. That town has so much creativity and has boasted some of the most influential inventions of the past century, as well as some incredible art and music. And I've just always been so incredibly proud to have grown up there, which leads me to the introduction of today's guest, documentary filmmaker and fellow Dayton, Ohio native, Stephen Bognar. He's also part of a filmmaking team with his partner, Julia Reichard. The two of them have had a really incredible career and have made so many meaningful documentaries throughout the years. And most recently, Steve and Julia won the Oscar Award for Best Feature Documentary for American Factory last year. I believe that film also took home top prize at the Sundance Film Festival, where it premiered last year as well. And it's an incredible piece of work. You can see it on Netflix. Steve and Julia are just quintessential documentary filmmakers. Their work is touching, it's powerful, and it's just incredible. So not surprising, Steve pulled two documentary films as his recommendation for a double feature, which I thought were a really nice pairing. So let's just head on over to my conversation with Stephen Bognar.
Aaron?
Hey, Steve.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
You know, I'm good. Life's it's busier than I thought it would be given the global pandemic, but it's good. It's funny.
So how are you guys doing?
It's funny. We had a lot of things lined up before the world shut down. You know, we had this new film that was going to premiere at South By. It's called 9 to 5, The Story of a Movement. And it was going to premiere at South By. We were so excited. We had other festivals coming up down the pike. And we were looking forward to a big launch. And then, of course, and we were racing like crazy to get it done. And then, you know, it all shut down. Yeah. And so then on top of that, our earlier film, A Lion in the House, which came out in 2006 on PBS, just got an offer to go on to Netflix. So we're getting that ready for Netflix, and that's a bunch of work. And then our movie American Factory is lucky enough to going to be on the Criterion Collection. And so we are getting ready for that and working on like DVD extras and stuff like that.
Oh,
and then
fantastic.
We're also Yeah, that's really wonderful too. And then on top of that, we're doing a lot of the events that we were going to do have turned into, online events. So we're actually still doing workshops and teaching, guest teaching things pretty much like every week. We're doing a few of them. So it's like we're still really busy and things keep popping up, you know. But I don't know. It's okay. It's better than just like staring out the window. You know, and we're very lucky. Oh my Lord. I mean, we have grandkids, but we don't have little kids in the house. So we are not dealing with stuff that you and so many of my friends are dealing with, which is how my daughter and son-in-law are dealing with, which is how do you get work done and have small children running around? It's really challenging.
It is a challenge for sure. And just keeping them, I just feel bad for them too, because they're kids and they want to be out and play and run around and, you know, they're just inside so much. And it's a delicate balancing act for sure. And we haven't spoken since the Oscar win too. So congratulations. I wanted to give you a proper congratulations on that. That's such a wonderful thing to see that. I was cheering loudly from my living room when you guys went up. Very proud to see that. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank
and
you.
That's really wonderful news. It's on Criterion as well. That's fantastic. I'm such a big fan
it's very meaningful. You know, it's very meaningful that Criterion wanted to do that. And it's incredibly meaningful that Netflix wanted to show our earlier film, A Lion in the House, which, you know, took us 10 years to make. It was the most intense film we've ever made. It broke our hearts. And, it was just a huge mountain that we climbed. It had a big day in the sun back in 2006, 2007, but it's been on a shelf for a little while now. And for it to be accessible again, it's going to be really meaningful for us.
Yeah, that's wonderful when films get new lives like that. That's really great. Well, in terms of watching movies at home,
I do want to say one thing, Eric. Speaking of watching movies at home, me and Julia finally got a chance to watch your movie, the Brainiac movie.
Just
two nights ago. I feel so bad. It took me so long to watch it. And now I'm just kicking myself because I wish I would have watched it like a year ago. It's wonderful. It's so wonderful. It took me so back to the 90s. I think the filmmaking is super strong. The storytelling, the way the way it's cut, you weave the era and the individual characters beautifully. Everyone's reactions to Tim's death, you know, it was really beautiful and very touching. And I thought really beautiful work. And of course, it was just great to see all that footage and all those people. Yeah. So I really love it,
man. I really appreciate that.
Well, I'm really sorry and I'm embarrassed that it took so long for me to watch it, but it's really wonderful.
No worries there. I mean, I have DVDs stacked on my, you know, my television console that have layers of dust on them. there's so many great works out there and so many things that takes me a very long time to get around to that are things that I've been dying to see too. So no apology necessary.
Yeah.
And thank you. That means a lot coming from you guys. Certainly.
Wow. No, it was really so engaging.
That's great, man. I'm really glad you guys got a chance to check it out. That's very cool. I'm glad you dug it. Well, let's transition on into some home viewing recommendations, because this series is about kind of keeping people, stimulated at home, film fans that maybe are looking for some things that they haven't heard of, or to kind of rediscover some old pieces and reexamine them. So go ahead and give me your recommendations for a double feature, and then let's get into why a little bit.
Well, I appreciate you asking me to do this, Eric, and I'm excited about this new, you know, this new podcast that you've got going. And so when you said two films that would sort of play off each other and be a good double bill and inform each other, I started thinking, what are films that do that? And for some reason, two films popped into my mind, both feature-length documentaries. One came out this year, just premiered, and the other is from, I think, 2011, 2012. It's one of my favorite documentaries. I think it's a truly great documentary. So the older film is called How to Survive a Plague, and it's directed by David France, who has just premiered a new film at Sundance this year called Welcome to Chechnya. And then the newer film is called Crip Camp, and that film is directed by Nicole Noonan and Jim Lebrecht. So Crip Camp just premiered at Sundance this year, won the Audience Award, had massive acclaim, and just premiered on Netflix. And it tells the story of the birth of the disability rights movement and how it, in many ways, the seeds of that movement were planted at a camp, a summer camp for kids with disabilities and or teenagers with disabilities. How to Survive a Plague tells a story of ACT UP and the activists who put their bodies on the line to try to accelerate AIDS research and call attention to the need for AIDS research. And I love both these films. I think they're both great films, amazing films, but they're also kindred in that they're stories of movements. They're not stories of like one heroic individual. They are stories of communities coming together. And I love this kind of movie because, you know, the Hollywood archetypal narrative is that it's usually one hero, one heroic person who somehow saves the day. And if you look at the world, the way actually things change, the way things get better is it's bands of people, it's groups of talent, or people who don't think they have any talent, but then suddenly they've got a fight in their soul, in their blood, and they take to the streets, or they find hidden resources within themselves that they never knew they had. But they do it collectively, and they do it with a lot of sacrifice. And so both these films have that. They're quite different, of course. You know, one's set in the 80s, the ACT UP story, you know, starts in the early 80s and really takes off and just becomes this sort of ferocious battle with the Reagan administration and then later the Bush, the first Bush administration. The story of the activists in the disability rights movement starts in the 70s when they were just these kids that, as they say in the movie, nobody wanted to see. And many people thought, you know, why are you even alive? You know, see, this is another parallel. In both cases, whether you were a young gay person or LGBT person in the 80s or a disabled kid in the 70s, a lot of people just didn't even want you to be alive, you know? And when these crises started or these movements started, that was their point A. It's like the world doesn't care about us. If we're going to change things, we got to change it ourselves. And both movies have that kind of quality, which I love.
I agree 100%. I really like in Crip Camp too, the sort of juxtaposition of the hippie movement, because this camp took place upstate in New York as well. And I love that, like, this is the Woodstock era and the whole kind of counterculture is happening. And yet within all of that, where the most kind of iconic counterculture hippie movement event occurred very close by in proximity was this thing that was happening too, which was, you know, unknown by everyone virtually. And yet was also spawning this sort of, movement of acceptance and beauty. And there's this sort of sequence with the Richie Havens song Freedom that I think is so beautiful. And that song is very well-traveled territory, obviously. But every time I hear that song from the Woodstock performance, it really moves me. And set to this montage of these kids at this camp kind of experiencing freedom, I thought was very beautiful and powerful.
Yeah, I love that scene too. It fluidly goes, you know, someone brings up the fact that Woodstock happened, the concert happened right nearby where they were, and mm-hmm. but underneath you realize, oh, actually that's been Richie Havens playing that song, and then it suddenly we cut to Richie Havens at Woodstock, you know, and it's like a really lovely fluid little edit right there. That was fun. Yeah, I also love the, you know, when the first time we see Jim Lebrecht who's both co-director of the movie and also one of the protagonists in the story. He's talking about how he heard about this camp run by hippies for disabled kids. But, you know, he said, someone told me you'll probably end up smoking pot with the counselor. And he says, well, sign me up. You know, I love that. it's a wonderful moment. Yeah.
It is really great. No, and they have a lot of wonderful archival footage. I'm always so pleased when I launch into a doc from that long ago, and especially like kind of on an esoteric subject, and there is a lot of actual footage that you can sink your teeth into. It's really, really nice when that gold mine exists, you know.
It's almost, you know, I almost feel like if you didn't have that kind of trove of footage, you can't even make the film, or it becomes a super different film. The fact, and this is a parallel between both these movies, How to Survive a Plague has amazing archival footage from the ACT UP meetings. And you just feel the electricity in the room. You feel the urgency and also of the protests on the streets and people being dragged off and roughed up by cops. It's just so kinetic. It's so immediate. And Crip Camp is incredibly lucky that they have this trove of, I mean, geez, it's black and white, like open, real, 1-inch port-a-pack videotape, a technology that hasn't existed for decades now. And in both cases, the footage looks crude and rough, but that doesn't matter because it's got this immediacy, you know. In Crip Camp's case, it's like the goofiness of youth and the sort of the rebellious spirit of youth. And in How to Survive a Plague, it's like people putting their bodies in the streets to fight for their loved ones. And but imagine if you didn't have that kind of trove of footage in either case, how do you tell that story with the same level of urgency or immediacy? So yeah, in both cases, the filmmakers were incredibly lucky. I just watched, getting ready for this, doing this with you, I rewatched How to Survive a Plague, and it's just emotionally overwhelming the how they were fighting, and yet around them, their friends and loved ones were dying left and right, you know, and yet they kept fighting to push the government for more AIDS research, and to take it seriously, you know. I mean, the Reagan administration didn't even acknowledge the existence of AIDS for years, and let alone put any priorities in it. And it's like Larry Kramer says at the end of the movie, near the end of the movie, he says, you know, the way that these eventual cocktails of drugs were found, it's like it wasn't found by the government. It was found by us, by the gay community who fought for their loved ones. And it's just deeply inspiring how this small band of people who were on the outside fought their way in and ultimately changed things. But then again, the same is true with Crip Camp. You know, it's like when you see that footage of the sit-in in San Francisco, a 23-day long sit-in occupying the Health and Human Services building in San Francisco. It's amazing to see all these folks with serious disabilities basically having to sleep on the floor, not having their usual support systems, not having their caregivers, because they've taken over a building. You know, they've literally, again, put their bodies on the line to fight for what's right and to affect change. And it's just really, in both cases, it's really inspiring.
Yeah, they're almost both war films in a way, you know, instead of, you know, kind of violent actions being fought over territory. These are wars and battles being fought to change people's minds and change government policy and government way of thinking, you know, but with actual, real, legitimate casualties that are happening around them.
Yeah, literally.
As well.
True.
Yeah, exactly.
People were dying.
Exactly.
In both right. cases, more so in the AIDS crisis, but in both cases, people were dying because they didn't have what they needed to live. And in many ways, it was
more bigotry than anything else.
Society. Yeah, well, and right, overcoming bigotry, grappling with it. Yeah. I mean, another thing I love about Crip Camp is how it's sort of very organically intersectional. You know, it's like, it is about disability rights, but it also grapples with LGBT stuff and race questions and, you know, sexuality questions in a very organic way, and gender stuff too, you know, and sexism. It's all kind of woven together. It doesn't make a big deal about it, but it's just really lovely, organic filmmaking. It had to be in both these films had to be tremendously hard to edit, because you're balancing individual portraits of certain activists or people with, the, you know, larger story of a movement. And that's, you know, like, when do you spend time with an individual and when do you go back to the main big story? In both cases, the films are doing that in just a really smart way. The minute you start craving, you know, more time with a certain character, suddenly the film somehow magically realizes you want that, and it gives it to you, you know? And I just think that's really, really brilliant.
I agree 100%. I think when that tightrope is sort of walked delicately and properly, that is, like, for me anyway, some of the most effective documentary filmmaking that I enjoy is kind of watching this overall narrative, but jumping in and out of little stories that just make you much more deeply tied to the people that are involved in this bigger thing. And it's tricky. It's really, really hard to do. And these do them masterfully. I agree. It's one of those things that, I'm sure they spent a lot of time, with some heavily debating about, yeah. Especially Crip Camp, because there are two directors and you are very, aware of what that's like, having a directing partner as well. So I'm sure there's some many heated nights or in the edit about decisions.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And I mean, I think a good editing room is full of debates. You know, I think it's, I mean, certainly Julia and I have found this over the years, and we're making American Factory, with working with our great editor, Lindsay Utes, and our producer and beloved nephew, Jeff Reichert. You know, we were with American Factory. We were always questioning, like, when are we telling the larger story and when are we going back to individual portraits of people, and who should that be, and how much time does this individual get? And it's constant problem solving and figuring out and looking at, and then stepping back to look at the balance. I think a huge part of it is you got to step away and show the film, to maybe do a test screening or just take a few days off so your head can clear, and then watch it and then try to see where's the overall balance of the recipe, you know, because it's always trial and error, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is a wonderful pairing. Thank you for this. I think these are great. I think there's a lot of connectivity between these two. I think they're really both very powerful pieces. Also very timely for what we're all kind of collectively sitting with and going through right now. So thank you for these.
Even more so, you know, it's funny, Eric, it is even more timely in a weird way, because in How to Survive a Plague, a person who's very prominent or regularly prominent in the film is Dr. Anthony Fauci. You know,
right.
Yet he's 30 years younger, right? And yet he comes up in the film again and again, and he's very much criticized by ACT UP, and he also is speaking with ACT UP and going to meetings and stuff and grappling with it, and so it's weird to see him now on the news again with this global pandemic that's going on, but. I just think it's fascinating to see these some of the same issues of how do you address an epidemic or a pandemic. There's definite parallels.
Well, thank you again for these. I think they're really wonderful. It's a great pairing. I think that people should seek these out, and they are very timely. And also, you know, I think they speak a lot to digging for a better collective humanity, which I think we could all use right now too. This is a very
Absolutely.
Difficult moment in our history, and I think that you know, a lot of people are reaching out for meaning and for connection. I think these films both bring that to you in a very powerful way. So
hats
off for the pairing. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Eric. And you know, so Crypt Camp is available on Netflix, and then How to Survive a Plague is available. It's like a $4 rental on Amazon.
I saw it on Amazon for rent. Yeah, exactly. Great. Well, thanks again for your time, man. I really appreciate you hopping on the phone with me. Give my best to Julia, and congratulations again for all the success. I really look forward to seeing, you know, your new film later on this year. And thanks again for the pairings. Hang in there.
Okay, Eric. Thank you so much. And you too. Stay safe. Good luck with your family and your work and all in one confined place.
Thanks, man. Let's keep in touch.
Good luck.
And be well. All right. Take care.
Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.
So that's our show. Really great conversation with filmmaker Stephen Bognar. I'd like to thank him for being on the program today. Once again, his picks were How to Survive a Plague and Crypt Camp. Crypt Camp is streaming now on Netflix. How to Survive a Plague you can catch on Amazon. Keep an eye out for Stephen and Julia's new film, 9 to 5, The Story of a Movement, which looks fantastic. Should be out later this year. Keep tabs on them. Also, if you haven't seen it yet, American Factory is still streaming on Netflix and will be coming to Criterion Collection very soon, so check that film out. Stay up to speed with all things Contiki Podcast on our Instagram page, which is at Contiki Podcast. You can check out all the latest episode postings there, as well as my double feature picks of the week. Please subscribe to us and rate us on any platform where you get your podcasts. And thanks again so much for tuning in. We will be back next week with yet another double feature film recommendation from one of your favorite artists. Until then, hang in there and be well. We'll see you next time.